The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And we are coming to you once again live. As many of you know, we are, I guess you could say, on break, or, well, our offices are closed for the most part as we keep the Feast of Tabernacles, a festival commanded in the Bible that Jesus Christ set the example for us keeping. But then with so many news events, we want to keep something close to kind of our regular schedule going with the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and keeping programs coming to you to keep you up to date with important world events. That just because maybe we've got our offices running a bit slower than normal, that doesn't mean that world events run slower than normal by any means. We had a show yesterday from Mr. Dwight Falk, who is the man behind the scenes of so much of what happens on KPCG, of all of our video content on the trumpets and all of the with the Key of David program, and a lot of the rest of our output there, producing and filming a lot of that material. We had lots of great feedback from his show. I didn't actually bring any of the comments with me, but quite a lot of people were very enthusiastic to hear what he had to say. So you can go back and listen to that on our website at kpcg.fm if you want to keep up to date with the programs that we're putting out at the moment. Well, obviously the big news today is that President Trump is out of hospital. That's the main focus, at least especially in all the US media. And I just kind of love the energy of watching him come out of this, just powering through this sickness pretty quickly, emerge, telling people, don't be afraid of COVID. Don't be afraid. And it's driving the left nuts. But what was this report? He told America to get out there, to not fear COVID-19 as he returned to the White House on Monday after just 3 nights in hospital. He said that he felt real good. There was a video of him. You may have seen the footage of him walking out of the hospital to the helicopter. They were shouting questions at him, and he was just giving the media a thumbs up. And then he put out a message, and it was on Twitter as well, saying, "Don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it." And talking about coronavirus, "We're going back. We're going back to work. We're going to be out in front. Don't let it dominate your lives. Get out there. Be careful." Which, I don't think I've ever been as jealous of American leadership. You just wish that we had somebody like that over here in the UK. If that had been the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's response after he got coronavirus earlier in the year. You know, don't be afraid of it. Sure, be careful, take some precautions, and you know, follow the laws of quarantine. If you're sick, stay at home. But you know, don't be afraid. Get out there and get back to work. But that's not what we're doing over here, unfortunately. Well, I thought I'd also give you a quick update on the war in Nagorno-Karabakh, seeing as I talked about that for a fair bit on Friday. The fighting there continues. One of the latest developments was over the weekend, and I think especially on Monday, Stepanakert, the kind of the capital of the region, came under attack, came under quite heavy artillery bombardment. And this is from the New York Times. It says, Stepanakert, once a city of well-tended boulevards and stately stone homes, is now scattered with the ruins of bombarded buildings. On Monday, it came under heavy bombardment for a second day, Armenia's military said. On the Azerbaijani side, the authorities said that rockets had landed in a residential area of Ganja, the country's second largest city. So in Azerbaijan, their second largest city is coming under shelling, with dozens of civilians killed on both sides. So both sides are firing large caliber Russian-made rockets they say that they're aiming for military targets, but then there were civilian buildings next door. And of course, each side with each hit is threatening to hit back and to try and take out the other, to retaliate. And there's pictures showing houses destroyed. The New York Times gives kind of a first-person account. It says, moments after the explosion rocked her building Monday, the people huddled in the basement rushed out. This is talking about somebody that was there. Smoke was billowing from a top floor. This individual left Stepanakert later in the day, driving past a grocery store in flames and another apartment building with a gaping hole in it. Water from broken pipes was pouring out through the ruined block. And she said, this individual said, seeing the city after the bombardment was very painful. And like we talked about on Monday, and we'll talk about a bit more today, God has this festival in the Bible that he talks about in the book of Leviticus, that Jesus Christ kept, that points to this time when there's going to be no more war. And now, right at the same time as we're keeping this feast, and that's where our minds are, you have a pretty significant war breaking out with tanks and drones and large-scale artillery. And it's just a tiny taste of the real world that we live in, of what man does to fellow man. And you know, this particular city, this talks about, there was war in this area 30 years ago, but there's been a lot of investment, a lot of money pouring in to this particular city. And it was, until Monday, a modern, nice, built-up city, the kind of place that any of us could imagine living in. And now it's a war zone. And now there's artillery raining down and buildings on fire and people huddling in basements and fleeing. That's the real world that we live in. And at this time of year, we focus on the future. We focus on the good news. We focus on what the Bible says about a time where war is going to end. But we need to understand what the world is really like right now to really appreciate that future. To really appreciate what it is really like, how fantastic that's going to be when war is over. Now, as I've mentioned briefly on Friday, it can be easy for those of us in Britain and America and lots of these other prosperous Western nations to get quite comfortable, to not really think of war as a real possibility. This idea, this promise, well, there'll be no more war. It's not such an immediate, urgent need for us because, well, we don't really have war in our everyday life. War is something that we watch on the television. But there's a lot of people now in Armenia and Azerbaijan really yearning for the time where there is no more war, where people don't learn war anymore. And God has a plan to put a stop to all of this violence. And what we're seeing in Armenia, in Azerbaijan at the moment, it's just a tiny, tiny taste of what is going to come to the whole world first. But that's all leading to God putting away war forever. And we'll talk a bit more about that in the second half. But another news story from yesterday that I didn't get a huge amount of time to, I didn't touch on at all because I was running out of time. But Prince Harry and his wife Meghan have been back into the headlines. They've been back speaking out again in a pretty major way. Those two, they left Britain for California saying they didn't like all the media attention that they were getting. And since then, they've given out all kinds of intimate details for a book. They've signed a huge deal with Netflix. I think that now, since then, it looks like they're going to be potentially in their own reality TV show. And Prince Harry is increasingly speaking out about systemic racism in the UK. Here's a video that he and his wife made. It's just a short clip, but it was a much longer video, I think about 20 minutes or so, for the Evening Standard here in the UK. This is clip two.
I've had an awakening as such of my own because I wasn't aware of so many of the issues and so many of the problems within the UK, but also globally as well. I thought I did, but I didn't. And this isn't about pointing the finger, this isn't about blaming anybody, this is just about using this opportunity.
So he's talking about, Britain is, there's systemic racism in the UK. We're racist, and we just kind of faded it out. He starts talking about this long, long sentence. But they wrote an article, the two of them, saying the world is created by white people, for white people, and talking about systemic racism. Britain is a fundamentally racist country. That's the message that they're bringing. Now, the facts show that that's not true. Fraser Nelson in The Telegraph had a great article a few months ago crunching the numbers. And I think you could say exactly the same thing about the United States. And I think he did crunch some of the numbers for the United States too, where well, one of the things that he drew attention to in Britain, and I think it's the same for America, is that people with Indian heritage, not American Indian, but from, you know, India in Asia, tend to, on average, earn more. They earn more than average. People of Pakistani heritage tend to earn less. And so he raised the question, well, is Britain some weirdly racist society where we discriminate against people from Pakistan, but not discriminate and actually favor people from India? You know, if racism is behind all of the different inequalities, well, that's a bit of a weird kind of racism. And he said, well, no, obviously there's something much more going on here. And there are a whole bunch of headlines, even just over the weekend, where I think it was something like only 8% of poor white British boys go to university. So again, if you're looking at people suffering those kind of disadvantages that those that talk about systemic racism all the time point to, is that group being discriminated against? Is there racism there? But it is sad to see this throne become a tool for division. I don't think there really is any higher profile figures in the UK saying Britain is fundamentally a racist society than Prince Harry and Meghan. That's kind of astonishing that these royals are now probably the most senior people in the UK pushing this movement. Now, there are other senior people. I just don't think anybody quite has the profile that these two do. They're making a massive impact in pushing forward this idea that Britain is fundamentally racist. I mean, the Labour Party, the main left-wing party here in the UK, they do have leaders that say that kind of thing. They do have politicians that talk like that. But then the very top, Keir Starmer, who's the leader of the Labour Party, you could kind of say their candidate to be prime minister, their candidate to lead the country. You know, he took a knee for Black Lives Matter, but he doesn't really talk a huge amount about race. Not as much and not in the same way that Prince Harry does. He's out in front even of a lot of the left-wing politicians. I mean, I guess we've got our equivalent of Maxine Walters, say, and some of those other ones that talk about it all the time. But really, you've got Prince Harry and Meghan bringing the throne of England, being the ones that are pushing division and pushing this idea that Britain is racist, telling people of different races in Britain, if you're dissatisfied of your lot in life, it's the fault of racism. It's the fault of the other people around you. You're spreading a message that divides and spreads hatred. Let's turn over to Ezekiel chapter 34 to talk about it. I don't want to spend too much time on this story because we've talked a fair bit about this. If you are interested, if you do want to hear much more about the royal family, I'd really encourage you to go back. I think it was a week or two ago, Mr. McDonald was filling in on the Trumpet Daily radio show, and he gave a whole program talking about, or most of the program talking about what's happening in the royal family, talking about how important it is to watch this, what Meghan and Harry are doing in bringing that family down. And he was playing some clips. He was talking about the Bahamas whichever country it was that is leaving the Commonwealth, and how there's potentially lots more getting ready to leave the Commonwealth. There's a lot of bad news for the royal family right now, and he talked a lot about why in that show. But in Ezekiel chapter 34, this is a chapter that talks about lots of division. You know, verse 21 talks about people being scattered abroad. But then God talks about, well, how he's going to unify his people, how he's going to bring unity. And it says in verse 22, therefore I will save my flock, and they shall no more be a prey. And I will judge between cattle and cattle, and I will set up one shepherd, so there'll be unity over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David. He shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd, and I, the Eternal, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Eternal, have spoken it. So God is going to use David to bring unity to Israel, to all Israel, even these different nations that are, or different people that are divided into different countries at the moment. He's going to bring use that king to bring unity. Now we've got these descendants, or these people that, you know, you can read the United States and Britain in prophecy and see how that royal family is descended from King David, but they're bringing division. And as Mr. Flurry talks about in the new throne of David, well, God had to make a major change in how he deals with that family and with that throne. And you can see why when you see that throne just bringing division. I mean, one more quick basic scripture, Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9, we'll start in verse 6, a verse that we turn to quite often, especially at this time of year. It says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end upon the throne of David, and upon his kingdom to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from henceforth, even forever." So God is going to give Christ this throne. He's going to sit on the throne of David. You can read about that in Luke chapter 1 as well. This throne, he's going to give Christ this throne. And Prince Harry and Meghan, who were in line for what was this, the same throne, they're now bringing division. But God wants to use it to bring unity, to unite people, to get people working together, not blaming each other. And so, as I said, it is sad to see the throne being used that way, but God has a plan for, and he's already started putting it into action, of making some major changes to that throne to make it a force for unity. And God is going to use that throne to unite all of Israel and even all the world. We'll leave that there for now. We'll talk about a few more different news stories. One story that ties it very directly into the Feast of Tabernacles into a pretty tragic way. Naturally, the Jews keep a version of the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, as they call it, where they have a festival on all the same days as those ones that are outlined in the Bible, in the book of Leviticus. And so they were keeping that day. And in Hamburg, a Jew attending this holy day, and very conspicuously a Jew wearing a kippah and you know, quite obviously coming, I think he was coming in out of a synagogue, he was brutally attacked. A man, he was like wearing army fatigues, he just beat him with a shovel in a pretty violent way. He didn't kill him, but he did. It says that in this article that he suffered grave head wounds and was taken to hospital. He's just coming out, keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, and he was coming out of a synagogue in Hamburg on Sunday, keeping the feast, and a man just starts beating him around the head with a shovel. Again, a sobering reminder of the world that we live in. The person, they haven't released too many details, but the person that attacked him had a swastika in his pocket. Another far-right crime in Germany. The foreign minister, Heiko Maas, wrote on Twitter, "This is not a one-off case. This is vile anti-Semitism, and we have to stand against it." And this article, I think this is the New York Times, it says, "Germany's seen the number of anti-Semitic crimes nearly double in the past 3 years. Last year alone, the government recorded 2,032 anti-Semitic crimes, culminating in the attack on a synagogue in Halle on October 9th. In that attack, a gunman tried and failed to force his way in during services for Yom Kippur, the holiest day on the Jewish calendar, and then killed two people elsewhere." So another brutal reality check for us. It's the world that we live in. But then, well, that can help us yearn for a time where these kind of attacks won't be happening. But what's going on in Germany that you're having these kind of attacks rise, that you're having 2,000 anti-Semitic crimes, and each year there are new records being set for anti-Semitism? Well, at the same time that you see this rise in the far right within Germany and far right crimes, more and more people are looking to Germany. We're seeing this now with the latest crisis in Belarus, where all of Europe is kind of looking to Germany as to what to do there. And the exiled Belarusian leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, probably butchered that, but she's one of the big figures that the opposition movement is rallying around, opposition to this dictator, and she's calling on Germany to get involved. She called on Germany to mediate. She said, "Germany is one of the most powerful countries in the world and can be very helpful." So she's appealing for Germany to get more involved. "It's extremely important because now we need help in mediation of our negotiations with the authority. and we think that Germany and its leaders can be extremely helpful in this situation. Now, I don't necessarily expect Germany to do a huge amount. I don't really expect them to... maybe they will, maybe they won't mediate, is what I'm saying. I don't necessarily expect one way or the other. I think Germany knows that for Russia, control of Belarus, or just at least keeping NATO out of Belarus, is non-negotiable, that Russia's just not going to let NATO walk in there. Germany knows that, and we've talked before about Germany and Russia's relationship with each other, where the two of them will work together. My point is just you're getting more and more countries looking to Germany, saying, well, Germany's a powerful country. We need them to do something. And at the same time, you see all of these things below the surface. Trouble brewing. This is another story from within Germany, again, from the New York Times. After a series of scandals involving far-right extremists in the German military, the government on Thursday dismissed the head of its military counterintelligence service, the body tasked with monitoring extremism within the armed forces. Thursday's announcement came 3 months after Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer disbanded one of four fighting companies in Germany's elite special forces, the KSK, because it was considered riddled with extremists. So there's so many extremists within the German army, they've basically now fired the head of their military counterintelligence. You know, saying, you're the one that's meant to be stopping this, and you failed. You've got to go. There are too many extremists within the German army. This and many other stories bring out something disquieting brewing under the surface in Germany. What is going on here? Obviously, the 20th century is full of examples of Germany causing major problems for the world. And what's happening that you're seeing some of this rise again? You're just in the last few weeks, you've seen people with the old imperial flag of Germany going back to Otto von Bismarck and World War I. The big protest movements, they've been waving this flag, the anti-corona protests, outside the German parliament, outside the Brandenburg Gate. And I think it's pretty easy to sympathize with with some of these protests against the coronavirus restrictions. So, I mean, if you've watched me sub in for any shows, you know that I get pretty frustrated by a lot of these restrictions. But you're seeing that movement in Germany, a lot of people that have this pretty extreme view of Germany's history and the role Germany should be playing in the world are joining in with these protests, waving the Imperial German flag, the flag of the Second Reich, out there in Germany. More and more often you're seeing this flag. So there's a lot of these things showing that there's something troubling happening in Germany. Now we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk about, well, how do you solve a problem like Germany? Because there is also a great hope and a wonderful future that the Bible talks about specifically for Germany. We'll be right back. Once again, we seem to have been having different trouble with the sound. Like I said, it always seems to happen when I'm in the studio here, because then I can't really have anyone that can come along and fix it. Maybe to our sound guys, if you could just unplug the USB and plug it back in again, we might get a bit of sound for our next clip. But I want to... There's an important... anniversary that took place over the weekend, one that ties in very strongly with this story that we are talking about. We'll give playing clip one a go now, and if we just get video, so be it. That's the most important part of it. So clip one. there is just the German national anthem, and they're playing with a big brass band there, you can see the Bundestag in Germany. And this is footage from 30 years ago, the official reunification of Germany, East and West Germany becoming one country. And so this 30th anniversary, it's a big anniversary, obviously, of this date. And you can see on that video, or you could just a second ago, some of the different leaders there meeting and joining together, and the celebrations that were going on there. And this 30th anniversary weekend, it's got a lot of people looking at Germany, talking about Germany, talking about Germany's role in the world. And there's one article in particular that I wanted to talk about. And this comes from the New York Times. Their Katrin Benhold, their bureau chief over in Germany, she has some great articles on the rise of the far right in Germany. There's obviously a lot, we've leveled lots of criticism at the New York Times, but her writing and her reporting on this subject really is fantastic. I'm afraid I didn't note down the title of this particular article, but it's definitely worth reading. I'll have to put it up on the headline section of our website. There's a lot of pretty negative coverage at the New York Times, but she's really sounding a warning about what is happening in Germany. You wish more people in America were paying attention. My guess is that this is not a particularly well-read part of the New York Times. It's not something that I don't think many people around the world are particularly interested in. But in her article, she writes, as it marks its 30th anniversary of reunification on Saturday, Germany can rightly celebrate being an economic powerhouse and a thriving liberal democracy. But reunification has another rarely mentioned legacy of unifying, empowering, and bringing into the open a far-right movement that has evolved into a disruptive political force and a terrorist threat, not least inside key state institutions like the military and police. So there's another legacy of reunification. Germany came together, but now you're having a rise of far-right extremism. She interviews lots of different people. One person is Matthias Quent, who's an expert in the far right. Or, I mean, really, I'm using the label far right. A lot of these labels don't make any sense. Far right and far left, there's very little difference between the two. You can argue that some of these far right groups would be better described far left, but far right is the common term and the one most people understand. But anyway, this individual, Matthias Quent, he said, today's far right extremism in Germany cannot be understood without reunification. And he talks about how reunification liberated the neo-Nazis in the East from their underground existence, and it gave the far right in the West access to a new pool of recruit and whole swaths of territory in which to move without too much oversight. This article says, for years, German officials trusted that a far-right party could never again be elected into parliament and dismissed the idea of far-right terrorist networks. Nothing to worry about here, nothing going on here. But some now worry that the far-right structures established in the last years after reunification laid the groundwork for a resurgence that has burst into view over the past 15 months. So we talk about a resurgence in America quite a bit, and there are Bible prophecies about that we base all of that talk on. There's a resurgence in Germany too. There's a resurgence in the past 15 months, the same kind of timescale that we've been seeing a resurgence in America. The New York Times now identifies as there being a resurgence in America as well. I mean, in Germany as well, a resurgence of the far right. And it talks about some of these things that we've seen just in the past 15 months. The assassination of a regional politician. The attack on the synagogue that we talked about earlier. Another that shot dead 9 people of immigrant descent in the western city of Hanau. Talks about how the government has disbanded entire parts of the military. How weapons have been going missing from the German military. How you're seeing a lot of far-right extremists in Germany's special forces. And so this article goes into all of those details. And Katrin Benhold has been really keeping on top of this story as it develops, as it's been developing just over even the last several months. And it talks about how these far right went underground within Germany after World War II. And one of the points that I found fascinating just reading from this article, you know, we at the Trumpet, we've talked a fair bit about how the far right went underground in West Germany, the bit of Germany that was controlled by America, Britain, France. After World War II, suddenly you couldn't find a Nazi anywhere. Everybody that worked within the German government and that had worked within the German government during World War II, well, those at the very top, they fled, they disappeared, they made themselves scarce. Everybody else kind of just said, I was just a low-level functionary. I didn't agree with the Nazis. In fact, I did all I could I stayed in my job so I could frustrate them and slow them down. And actually, I'm a committed Democrat. This is what they all said, and suddenly you couldn't find a Nazi anywhere. And they just kind of disappeared. They went underground. And then just over the last 10, 20 years, there have been a steady release of reports in German ministry after ministry showing that that was all lies and that all of these different people, they weren't mere functionaries that disagreed with the Nazis. They were full-on enthusiasts for what the Nazis were doing. And in so many cases, these people just stayed on in their jobs as judges in the Justice Department, as police, as in the educate, they just stayed on. So we've talked a fair bit about the way that the Nazis went underground in World War II, how not much ended up being done to denazify Germany in the West. This article also talks about the East, something that we haven't talked as much about, maybe because it's just been more opaque. You didn't have the free press over in East Germany reporting on it. And so this article says a potent neo-Nazi movement was growing underground. Well, that's exactly the same terms that we've been using, because that's a Bible term. It talks about this spirit of Nazism and the Holy Roman Empire being underground. Well, this article, it says that it was underground. I mean, that sentence in itself, Mr. Falk on his show on Monday mentioned the He Was Right book that we have, and he put in a strong plug for that. I think I mentioned it on Friday as well. But there's a section, or at least there was, I guess they keep changing some of the editions, but one of the things Mr. Armstrong said was, you're going to see the Nazis go underground. And he was saying this in 1945. The Nazis are going to go underground. That was 1945. Well, here we are, 2020. A Nazi movement was growing underground. It went underground. It happened. Mr. Armstrong said it would happen. You can now read the New York Times saying it did happen. And he was saying that because of fulfilled prophecy, and that book, He Was Right, is a great place to start to understand this message, to get into a lot of that fulfilled prophecy. Just going on with this article, it says, in 1987, Bernard Wagner, a young police officer in East Germany, estimated there are 15,000 homegrown violent neo-Nazis, 1,000 of which were repeat offenders. His report was swiftly locked away. So you've got East German police doing investigation and saying, well, we've got quite a lot of neo-Nazis and sympathizers, neo-Nazi sympathizers around here. And they warned about that, and report was locked away. They're not going to talk about that. Then this article says, 2 years later, as tens of thousands took to the streets in anti-communist protests that eventually brought down the regime, the pro-democracy activists were not the only marchers. The skinheads were marching too, Mr. Wagner recalled. So we focus on the pro-democracy movement that helped bring down the Berlin Wall and reunify Germany. And definitely that was a strong movement. I'm not saying at all that all of those were neo-Nazis. All I'm saying is, you read this and there were neo-Nazis there. They were still going. They were underground in West Germany and in the East Germany. This article says, during the early 1990s, a wave of racist violence swept through Germany, much of it in the East. Foreigners were chased, beaten up, and sometimes killed. Asylum homes were firebombed. Buses of immigrants were attacked. Sometimes Eastern onlookers would clap or join in. And we wrote about these. You can read about a lot of these in the Germany and the Holy Roman Empire booklet. You can go back. I was very young at the time, but I still have vague memories of some powerful Key of David programs that Mr. Flurry made the ones I remember, I guess, are more mid to late 90s, but based on some of those things that were happening as Germany reunified during the 90s, and you had this wave of racist violence, as it talks about. There was something revealed when East and West Germany came together, And there was this feeling among the far right and some of those that were underground that, well, now's our time. Now we're going to rise to the fore and we're going to see a new Germany. And it wasn't quite the time for the far right, I guess, at that point. And they got the message and quietened down a bit. But you're seeing this wave build up again, this underground build up again. This article quotes a historian, Volkard Nigge, saying, you could see that something was shifting, and not just on the fringes. Otherwise, the AfD would not be so strong today. Something was shifting. This historian, it talks about how he went to the east to go to run the former concentration camp in Buchenwald. And he said he was startled by the abundance of Nazi memorabilia, like Hitler's Mein Kampf, for sale at flea markets, by the mob of angry young neo-Nazis who would gather on the historic theater square shouting xenophobic slogans. He said, we thought democracy had won. The West thought this was the end of history, but for the nationalists, this was a revision of history. We thought the West was won. We thought we'd fixed this problem. This article goes on to talk about the World Cup in 2006. And the world was watching this liberal Western Germany, this pro-democracy Germany. And the West and the world loved what they saw. Modern, sophisticated, peaceful, very competent. And it was a great picture. And again, this article, it quotes Tanjav Schultz saying, I wanted to believe that's who we were as a country. And I did believe it. He was there in 2006 seeing this modern Germany that the world loved. And he said, yes, that's who we are. But he doesn't think so anymore. He says, but it wasn't true. What the world saw in 2006, with the World Cup, that's not really Germany. That's what this German is saying. That vision that was projected around the world, that the world fell in love with, that's not really Germany. That's quite a revealing statement. I remember, Mr. Ron Fraser was writing articles, similar articles, at the same time. And he wrote a lot of material pointing out that while you're seeing that he was talking about how the World Cup was making German patriotism more palatable and more popular, and how that would inevitably lead to a rise of nationalism and more extreme forms of that, and that's what we've seen. This article quotes someone else, Mr. Hasselbeck. And he said that he was not surprised to see the recent revelations of far-right infiltration of security services when he was still a neo-Nazi. So this is somebody that used to be part of that movement. When he was still a neo-Nazi, he said friendly police officers would warn them before raids or hand them files of leftist enemies. So the police officer, they'd pass on, okay, we're going to do a raid, or these are some people we want to take out. And we've seen more and more of that in recent years. Mr. Hasselbeck said the readiness to commit violence today is greater than it's ever been. And then this other person we talked about later is Mr. Wagner. He said, Westerners have no feel for how fragile things are. The elites don't see the post-democratic decline. Easterners have seen a system collapse before. Is that what we're seeing in Germany, a system collapse? Well, this is the New York Times. This is the newspaper of record, saying something's been underground in Germany that's been coming up in the last 15 months. And again, as much as we criticize the New York Times, credit by credit, where credit's due, they are sounding a kind of warning on this subject. You know, the New York Times saying this should be getting a lot of people sitting up and paying attention, and this is not the only time the New York Times has been saying this. You know, Katrin Benhold has been on top of this for months. All over summer, she's been having some great pieces. But America's not interested. Did you see this come up during the debates last week between Joe Biden and President Trump? Is this an urgent priority for America? Or something's coming up in Germany? No, they're not in. I mean, foreign policy at all barely made a mention during those debates. So how do you solve a problem like Germany? How do you solve this? You know, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, they had that document that we quote a fair bit on this show that talked about how Germany never rose, they wanted to make sure Germany never rose again. They said that was their inflexible purpose. And now you see while Germany rising again, the spirit rising in Germany. Margaret Thatcher, in 1990, before Germany was unifying, she complained that Helmut Kohl, the German leader, sees himself as the master and is starting to act like it. And she got together a group of British and American historians who cautioned against reunifying Germany, saying, well, they're going to dominate Europe. This is a bad idea. And we saw that push forwards, and now we're seeing Germany rise again and something disquieting under the surface. And we talk a lot about, and I've talked a fair bit about the show, about Bible, what the Bible says about this and going through those scriptures. We've done that quite a few times on this show, going through these scriptures that Mr. Armstrong used to forecast so exactly they're going to be underground. You can see those in Revelation chapter 17 that talk about this beast power that's ridden by a woman, and it gives so many details. You can match it up exactly with European history, and that chapter talks about this power going underground, disappearing from the world scene, coming right back again later. And I read an article just over the summer in the October Trumpet print edition. It says, why does Germany have so many neo-Nazi conspiracies? That goes into what we've been seeing in Germany over recent months, some of these warnings that have been coming from the New York Times and others. That will take you through those scriptures in much greater detail. And I'm sure we'll cover those scriptures again in this show. They're worth repeating. They're worth getting into. But I wanted to, given the time of year that we're in with the Feast of Tabernacles, focus on something a little bit different today. Not just what is the problem and what is happening in Germany, but what is the solution? We'll talk about Revelation 17:10, and there's so much profound truth there to unpack in these verses. But what's the problem, but what's the solution? How is God going to bring peace? Because the world is full of these long-standing enmities. You've got this repeated problem with Germany, and sure, some people will deny it, and very soon they won't be able to. We're going to watch them rise very quickly on the scene. But Armenia and Azerbaijan, long-standing dispute. Turkey and Armenia, where the Turks killed 1.5 Armenians, and you've got a long-standing enmity there. India and Pakistan, or Germany and Russia, or even just how do you deal with Russia, where you've got a long-standing enmity there. You've got all of these potentials all around the world for earth-destroying conflicts, where nations, even with nuclear weapons, hate each other, or have been at odds with each other for a long time. How do you solve about a problem like Germany? Now they failed after World War II. They wanted to find a way to bring peace, and lots of people said they succeeded for now. And then you see that changing. You see Germany changing. You see this thing coming up from the underground. But the Bible says these problems will be solved. Look at Isaiah chapter 19. It has wonderful prophecies of a time when these different former enemies are going to live in peace. And we read on Friday this prophecy that back in Isaiah 2, this one that's very well known about, well, they're going to beat their swords into plowshares. The nations won't learn war anymore. I always find that this particular passage really amplifies that, makes it really real, makes it come alive. Isaiah chapter 19 and verse 23, it says, in that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt. Well, is this war? Well, no, the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Eternal shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hand, and Israel my inheritance. You've got three peoples that have an enmity here going back thousands of years. Israel being enslaved in Egypt, Assyria being modern-day Germany in Bible prophecy, and you can read our book, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, for proof of that. But you've got these enemies, long-standing enmities, but now they're living in peace. They're working together. They're a blessing in the midst of the land. Isaiah chapter 10 talks about how God uses Assyria to punish Israel. We'll turn to a couple of that just to prove that this is indeed an end time passage. And it's not far away either. Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 5. It says, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in their hand is my indignation. So God uses Assyria to punish his people. And this did, Assyria did conquer the northern tribes of Israel anciently. But you can start reading in the rest of the chapter. You can look in verse 20, for example. It says, the remnant of Israel, such as escaped to the house of Jacob, shall no more stay upon him that smote him, but shall stay upon the Eternal, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. And it goes on and talks about Israel returning to God, God rescuing his people. Well, that didn't happen when Assyria took Israel captive anciently, because the book of Assyria is book of Isaiah is prophecy. It's prophecy for the future. God is going to use Assyria once again to punish Britain and America, and that's what we're seeing building in Germany, building in Europe. But then afterwards, there's this time where Egypt and Assyria, they're going to serve together and work together. Now, God uses them to punish Israel. Then God also punishes and corrects Assyria. And then you've got this time of peace. Mr. Armstrong wrote in the Wonderful World Tomorrow book, Egypt and Germany are pictured in loving, respectful, serving cooperation with the very peoples they contended with in the past. That's real progress. And I mean, this is a bit of speculation on my part, but as you read those scriptures, you kind of get the impression that these are the three leading nations of the world during the world tomorrow after Christ's return, that Israel shall be third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land. These three nations serve the world and give to the world. So there is hope for what we see happening and there is a solution coming for Germany. It's not going to be an endless cycle of violence, or all of these different enmities around the world aren't just going to keep going and going. And Assyria does have a very positive track record in the Bible. You can look at the book of Jonah, for example. Time and again, God sent prophets to a rebellious Israel to correct them. And time and again, they ignored them. They didn't listen. Yet as far as recorded in the Bible, God only sent one prophet to ancient Assyria, Jonah. And he went to Nineveh and he told them of their sins. And Jonah 3 and verse 5 says, well, the people of Nineveh believed God and proclaimed a fast and put on sackcloth, from the greatest of them even to the least of them. They repented. Even the king repented. And we mentioned at the start that you see this violence in Nagorno-Karabakh and some of these other places. Well, that's just a taste of what's coming. There's violence like that is going to cover the whole earth. It's coming to Britain. It's coming to America. Well, when you look in Isaiah chapter 19, this is why. It's a short time of violence. The Bible talks about it being very short. A brief tribulation, 3.5 years, and it will be terrible. But this is how God brings peace. This is how God brings these different nations that have been fighting, not for a short time, but for decades, for hundreds of years, for thousands of years. This is how he brings that to a permanent conclusion. He uses this violence to correct these nations, and then they will listen to him. They will be corrected. He says it about Britain. He says it about Israel. There are some wonderful prophecies in the book of Hosea. Well, there's some very sobering prophecies. But then in that same book, it talks about, I didn't write the scriptures down, it just kind of occurred to me now, but it talks about how Ephraim, Britain in Bible prophecy, is going to respond to, they're going to be corrected by that tribulation. They'll seek God. There's wonderful hope there. And other passages talk about how Israel will obey God after Christ returns and seek him. And you're going to see Assyria do that too, and Germany, or Germany and Egypt. They'll seek God. They'll be traveling up to God. The Bible talks about many nations going up to Jerusalem, saying, we want to go to the house of God. We want to go to headquarters. We want to learn that way of life, and we want to take it home with us. Germany will be doing that. Egypt will be doing that. We'll turn to a scripture in just a minute that shows many other nations will be doing that. So yes, you know, there's going to be violence, and we just get a very minor taste of looking at some of those modern weapons in Nagorno-Karabakh. But it's going to get much, much worse. It's going to get worse, but it's all for a wonderful reason. It's to bring an end to wars. People won't learn war anymore. And God talks about how he'll punish Assyria. They do become puffed up. They take credit for the calamities that fall upon the nations of Israel. But he never says that he'll destroy Israel. Instead, he talks about destroying that ancient pagan Babylonian system. He talks about that in Revelation chapter 18, Isaiah 47. That system, that false religion, will be destroyed. But Israel, Egypt, Germany, they're going to be strong nations, prosperous nations. There'll be a highway coming out of Assyria for the Germans to go up to Jerusalem and learn the truth. They're going to be freed from the shackles of that Babylonian religion that really is Satan's religion, and they're going to become more powerful than at any time in their history, and they'll be blessed. The whole world will be blessed because of it. That's how the German question will be solved. That's how we're going to have peace in the world. And you can look in, we'll turn over just one last scripture to Ezekiel chapter 38. Because it's not just Germany that's going to respond like this. God's going to correct all the different nations of the world. And they'll all be able to come to God and learn from God. And Ezekiel chapter 38, when we turn to this chapter, typically we're focusing on this prophecy at the in verse 2 there that talks about the prince of Rosh. And there's a leader that God singles out here who leads all of these different Asian nations against Israel. And we can see that leader, and we can see this alliance rising on the world scene. And it talks about God uses these armies. He uses them to correct Britain and America. He uses these armies to correct Germany. But then these armies themselves then need some correction from God. But the end result of it, it's talked about in verse 23. God says, "Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am the Eternal." Many nations are going to know that God is the Eternal. Now, verse 16 talks about this as well. I wrote down the wrong verse there. It might be maybe it's a different chapter. But anyway, there are other verses in there that talk about these nations coming to know God. They're punished. But then it's over. And they will know that I am the Eternal. And you have all these scriptures of many nations coming up to Jerusalem. And so, you know, yes, we do talk a fair bit about Germany and the rise of Germany. Yes, we warn about the bad news that's coming in the world. But during these holy days, during this Feast of Tabernacles especially, and throughout the year, but especially during, we look at the good news behind that. You know, God is teaching a lesson. God is giving us all of this prophecy. You know, God revealed to Mr. Armstrong, well, this beast is going to go underground and it's going to come right back again. And well, why does he do that? Why does God give him these prophecies? It's not so we can get an inside track or have some special secret knowledge. Book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 4, talks about how God gives it so that the living may know that God rules in the kingdom of men. God rules. God rules mankind. And then he teaches that today through Bible prophecy, and we get that prophetic message out through this program and through all of our magazines and the books and booklets that I'm pointing you to get into more detail from what the Bible says. And God's going to teach that through directly intervening in the world very soon. Teaching the world that God rules, that he is the authority in the world. And then, once the world learns this lesson and submits to God, well, then it's going to have these beautiful fruits. And there's so many beautiful scriptures that talk about the time of peace, prosperity, protection that we can have. And that's that same help from God, that same power from God. Well, that's available right now if we turn for him to him. Those same blessings. Obey God and we'll receive them today as well. So there's a wonderful hope and a wonderful purpose behind this message and a wonderful future for Germany and for the whole world. Well, that's about it for me. Please do keep tuning in. We will have more and more shows coming up during the week. I think Brent is on tomorrow, Brent Nachtigall. I was chatting to him a bit about what he's talking about tomorrow. He's just got a fascinating show coming up with some important developments of peace in Jerusalem. That's something for keeping the Feast of Tabernacles here. We've been hearing a lot about Jerusalem. Don't miss that show. I think you'll find that really interesting. And as usual, you can get in touch at td@kpcg.fm or tune in at 101.3 on the FM dial or at kpcg.fm.